Thank you all very much. Hello and welcome to the Royal Academy in London, where we're gathered to mark a very special occasion, the 80th birthday of one of the world's famous modernists, someone who has left his mark on many of the great cities of the world, and someone who is still, perhaps more than ever, contributing to the way those cities are evolving. I'm talking, of course, about Richard Rogers, the architect of the Pompidou Centre in Paris, the Lloyds Building in London, the Eastwards development of Sydney, the replanning of Barcelona, Barajas Airport in Madrid, and his rapidly ascending New York Tower on the site of Ground Zero. He takes the ancient Athenian oath of citizenship as his motto. We shall leave this city not less, but greater, better, and more beautiful than it was left to us. But how do you achieve that? And how successful has he been? The Royal Academy has staged an exhibition to explore his agenda-setting work, and it provides us with an excellent opportunity to explore the notion of the city with the man who has devoted his life to urbanism. He's been awarded Architecture's Nobel, the Pritzker Prize. He's won the Stirling Prize from the Royal Institute of British Architecture, and he continues to advise national governments and city mayors in several countries. Please join me now in welcoming one of the world's great architects, Lord Rogers of Riverside. Richard, while we're here in part to celebrate your eminence, there is a display at the start of this exhibition which does bring us all down to earth and gives us hope in equal measure, I thought. It's a report from your first year of study at the Architectural Association in July 1958, and it says, he has a genuine interest in and a feeling for architecture, but sorely lacks the intellectual equipment to translate these feelings into sound building. His designs will continue to suffer while his drawing is so bad, his method of work so chaotic, and his critical judgment so inarticulate. What on earth was going on, Richard?
I found education very difficult, especially my first third of my life, which gives me the excuse for saying I've enjoyed much more my last third of my life. Well, I found through my children that I was dyslexic, because of course dyslexia didn't exist when I was young, and people just said he was lazy or stupid. So I had a lot of difficulties. Fortunately, I was very much supported by my parents, especially my mother, who was a potter. And so they never quite gave up, even though I had lots of reports, and worse than that. I somehow made it just at the last moment in the final year, where I had the year prize and I was able to go on to Yale. But formal education, not for me.
So in that last year, you'd obviously developed the intellectual equipment somehow. Was there a turning point in that last year?
I don't know if there was. You know, I mean, at some levels, I was always interested in a broad spectrum of activities. I was politicized very young. My parents came from Italy in 1939. Bad idea to come be Italian or German in 1939, even more if you were five and went to a little English private school where the headmaster came from the Boer War. Not popular. So it was tough. It was very, very tough.
The British, of course, love to think of you as a great British export in the world, and many probably don't know that you weren't born here. As you said, your parents were Italian, and until you were five, you lived in the city of Florence. You're known now, of course, as a modernist, but that medieval and Renaissance city is incredibly important to you. Why is that?
Well, that's for many reasons. First of all, let me say, all architecture of their time is modern architecture. I often, you know, Brunelleschi had tremendous problems when he started with the dome. They put Ghilberti on top of him in the sense of, or senior to him, because they felt he was an academician. Brunelleschi wasn't. And our great Wren for St. Paul's, he built numerous models. Every time they were turned down because they were too modern, and the final one, he put a wattle fence, 20-foot wattle fence around the St. Paul's, so that nobody could see what he was putting up inside, because it was too modern. So as far as Florence is concerned, of course, it's a fantastic Renaissance city. In terms of loving a city, or believing that cities are the heart of man, if you like, very complex organizations, then the city-state is the Florentine state.
When one thinks about the building that put your name on the international architecture map, the Pompidou Centre in Paris, the notion of the piazza, which comes from the city that you grew up in and other Italian cities, was that something that you had in your mind at the outset?
I think that I had a very early interest in the idea of the public domain. And in a way, one enjoys cities primarily because there is public domain. It's a meeting of people. Cities are the engines, both of the market and of culture, the heart of culture. And it's the meeting of people in these spaces which makes it so exciting. It doesn't have to be in a piazza, it can be in a beautifully proportioned alleyway. But the concept that cities contain places where people can exchange ideas and meet others, that's what's excited me.
The exhibition here at the Royal Academy is called Inside Out, and that's because one of the things that you are known for is putting the amenities of a building, like lifts and air conditioning ducts, on the outside of buildings to free up the space inside. Let's talk in a little bit more detail about the Pompidou Centre, which was shocking at the time, and even today, startlingly looks like a factory, or at least it did then as well, to Parisian eyes in the early 1970s. But you very famously call it a place and not a building. Just explain your and Renzo Piano's thinking about the building in that context.
It was the first major competition in Europe. There had been Sydney Opera House a few years earlier in Sydney. And when we started looking at it, we realized a library, a museum, a music center, a design center. Really what we wanted to do was to make it attractive to the public again, back to the public space. We examined the area around. It was very dense. It was the Jewish ghetto, in fact, which was in pretty bad condition in those days. So we decided that a piazza was critical. The public domain was critical. The first words of the report which we wrote was a place for all people, all ages, all creeds, the rich and the poor. And then the following thing was across between Times Square and the British Museum. Fun palace, Times Square, fun place, if you like, and obviously British Museum, serious and study. And to get those working together, it, in a way, it's easy to say developed, the building came out of it, but it certainly gave the building a specific sense. And those who've seen it will know the piazza, which is about half the site, but the piazza goes on up vertically. In other words, you have a horizontal piazza, which everybody has, but this building has a vertical piazza. You could say that the steps in Rome, the Spanish steps, do the same thing. But you go up the facade, streets in the air, escalators in the air, and it's very much a public building.
Why does that matter to you when you look back on that experience? Because it wasn't, you know, there were 681 people who entered that competition, and you and Renzo Piano were, what, in your early 30s, mid-30s?
Yes, and I think we were the only ones who actually, interestingly enough, had a piazza. In our competition, where we covered, as I said, half the ground. But it's because one comes to the fact that architecture is socially driven. I mean, that's really the critical element. Of course, you try and make things beautiful. I don't want to underplay the importance of the aesthetics, but it is social, political.
And at the time, give us a sense of the reaction to both your plan and the final building.
I suppose others have suffered this. I'm sure they have. But there wasn't a single piece of media for the 6 years that we built the building. In fact, there were two, to be absolutely true. One, New York Times, twice, said something good about the Pompidou. But generally, unbelievably hated. At first we were horrified, and then we just got on with it. I do remember when it was just about complete, on a rainy day, for instance, standing, looking up at the building, small lady came along with an umbrella and said, do you want to take shelter? And I said, thank you very much. And she said to me, what do you think of the building? And I said, very stupidly, I was the architect, which I never do. And she hit me on the head with an umbrella, so it was very unpopular.
But that didn't stop you from taking that inside-out style to the City of London, and it provoked just as much of a reaction, if not more, controversy. And I'm talking, of course, of the Lloyd's building in the city, with its glass elevators whizzing up on the outside and polished steel ducts wrapping around the exterior walls. It was definitely a new experience for the City of London, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I don't know if it's a style. I find that word slightly difficult. Though, as I said, all architecture is modern in its time, which is a form of style. I mean, it comes out again out of certain beliefs. The idea that you have to have tremendous flexibility. When we started the Pompidou Centre, of which probably the library was the most important part, we were housing books. By the time we finished Pompidou Centre 5 years later, books hardly existed. IT had taken over. And that's a fantastic change, both of the amount of space, how you service it, and so on. You could say much the same about Lloyd's. Change is very fast. And again, I think we're not allowing ourselves to think about the future. We build today, we measure against the past, but we do try to imagine what's going to happen in the future. If you are going to look at the future, you've got to say change is the only constant and allow for change. The interesting part about putting in mechanical services, the movement of things, structure on the outside, it allows you big spaces on the inside which you can do anything. So we used to say lawyers could be turned into a university. You never know how long, you know, with IT, whether Lloyd's will continue. It has continued, but there was questions at the time whether it would continue. So if you want fluidity, flexibility, the tendency is to move things to the outside, simple structures, no interruptions inside. If you do that aesthetically, it gives you the things to play with in terms of molding the building, of light and shadow, which is what architecture is, the play of light and shadow. So rather than having brick, glass, steel, whatever it is on the outside, you start to articulate that facade. That, in a sense, you could argue is the style.
I went to visit the Lloyd's building last week, and what was really extraordinary was how at home these masters of the universe, if we're still allowed to call them that, these financiers looked in their workspace. They almost seemed conscious of how good-looking the building looked as a backdrop to their business suits. I wondered if you can say a little bit about what you think has happened to make people more accepting of radical design.
I think the shock of the new is pretty typical. I always quote a letter in Florence, the Strozzi Palace, which is one of the largest palazzos, 14th century palazzos in Florence, where some neighbors had written, you know, why do we have to have this massive building, dash skyscraper? Because after all, they were single story. This building was four story, probably eight stories, because they were double size. And, you know, the shock of the new is always, and in England, certainly the visual arts after the war was very, the understanding of the visual arts was very, very poor. Terrific writing, music, and so on. Visual arts, very poor. So I think that, you know, one has to get over that shock and look at it as much as possible within the context of the contemporary world and how it meets the needs of the contemporary world, both functionally and aesthetically.
You're back in the City of London again at the moment, building the Leadenhall building, or it's called the Cheese Grater. I don't know how you feel about that name. Do you like that?
I think in a sense it shows somebody's interested in it.
Well, it's right next to the Lloyd's building.
That's called the coffee machine. I'm all for food.
What does it feel like to be building back in the city in the same space again? Is there a sense that nearly 30 years later you're actually finishing work at street level which you started in the late 70s?
I'd say the city has become dynamic and wonderful. In the last 20 years, 15 years, London has changed totally from rather a grey and blackish capital to sliding downwards to what is probably the greatest city in the world. I mean, maybe New York competes. So that's a fantastic feeling of a fantastic spirit. What's interesting in comparison between Lloyd's and Leadenhall is that we thought Lloyd's was, in a way, very much a technological building. We prefabricated the toilets and they came in on big cranes, and the pipes and the glazing was specially made so they would sparkle, because they didn't want to be Lloyd's is really very much a club. They don't want to be seen inside, and so on. And now with Leadenhall, I mean, the building is so much, technology is really taking it. The whole facades come up in Leadenhall. It's much simpler, it's much less articulated, because technology has changed. And of course, what we have on Leadenhall is St. Paul's in the distance. So that's a view of St. Paul's. So the building has to slope that way to get out of the view of St. Paul's. And London is unique in being partly controlled by views. And then we had this client, British Land, who accepted having a seven-story space under the building as public space, which is fantastic.
Is it in some senses a less shocking building than Lloyd's was in the 70s?
It's very difficult to ask, or for me to answer. You can ask easily, but it's difficult for me to... it probably is, but we are much more used to, I'm going to call it contemporary architecture, modern architecture. You know, if we think of... I do remember when the first Picasso show was shown at the V&A, and we had the most intelligent people, including our prime minister at the time, saying, you know, my donkey can paint better than Picasso could. we have got sort of over that, well, partly over that. But of course, we are always trying to catch up. We'll never be absolutely, things are changing fast. And in the sense, you can make an argument that certainly we are now old hat, our practice, in the sense, I hope we're not, but we are in terms of the youth of today, as we should be. So I mean, we do have to remember that when 20 years ago, when we tried, immediately after Lloyd's, 30 years ago, I suppose, we tried to build a building next door, and we were told that, you know, we were not to build any more modern buildings. And we were given, I remember, by the then city architect, a photograph of some building in Glasgow to copy, and that was only 30 years ago. I don't think that would happen today.
You're listening to Changing the City, an audience with Richard Rogers on the BBC World Service. We've been discussing the Lloyd's Building, the Pompidou Centre in Paris, Florence, and city squares. Later, we'll be discussing Richard's work on city planning and the finance that defines our urban environment. But now, who would like to ask a question on what we've been talking about so far? Oh, a hand's gone up there.
I think we had a royal comment, which I think was from Prince Philip. He was discussing the cheese grater and the gherkin, and he tied together some funny string about how London was ending up looking like a picnic basket or something. And I think his point was quite fair, actually, that if you have a number of buildings in London which are individually quite dominant, they end up sort of maybe overshadowing each other or becoming messy in some sense. And I just wanted to know if you ever think a cityscape can become messy, whether you do actually see a city from that perspective.
I think that cities, by their very nature, tend to be what you call messy, I suppose. That's partly part of their vitality. But they don't all have to be. I mean, one of the questions I was asked, I think, this morning, you know, are any towns designed in one go beautiful? And I said, look at Dubrovnik, fantastic. Look at parts of London. Look at Nash's Mile. Look at the fantastic Georgian architecture. So there are, we're harming, but that's not, if you go to Florence, it is messy. It's just we've got used to it. What we love of those Renaissance buildings is the way that behind them or around them is a totally different scale medieval buildings. They're small, they're articulated, they're messy to use that word, whereas the Renaissance buildings stand rather proudly and have a dialogue through contrast rather than a dialogue through harmony.
More questions?
Hi, I'm Louise. I'm from Fort Greene in Brooklyn. I just wanted to ask about public space, because you mentioned with the cheese grater that you got a deal to have the public space below, and I wondered just how important you thought that was, because a lot of buildings, when they're built by private corporations, we don't get the access, say, we do to a church in Florence or a church in London.
Well, at this building, and I agree with you, by the way, of course, it's a battle. In other words, it's a battle because the client, after all, is the especially if big businesses are basically there for making money. So it is not easy. It wasn't difficult on the British Land building. On the other hand, this square is open. There's not it's not a glazed-in atrium. There will be some glass to stop some wind, but it's open. It is a difficult. On Lloyd's of London, the ground floor, so a bit lower than ground floor, was going to be all public. It was closed, not so much because of Lloyd's, but because of the security problem. Security is one of the difficult problems. Pompidou Centre, people say, well, why doesn't it have an entrance? And I used to say, because it was meant to have 12 entrances. There was no main entrance. Then security comes along, whether it's, you know, whatever, whoever's taking over the streets at that time. And the immediate reaction of the people who own it, understandably, is to close the building. So there was that battle. And, of course, the famous Nolli plan in Rome, which is a wonderful plan, 17th century, 18th century, can't remember, which defined all the public zones in Rome, and including all the alleyways, streets, and so on, and all the churches, where you saw at least 60% was public. That was, in those days, much more public than it is today because of security. Security is a battle. We've been now for some years working on Ground Zero, And when we started working on one of the towers, which had been obviously, as you know, but sadly just blown up, the first time we went there, when we were told, you've got the first 30 feet must be concrete. And I said, well, if you're going to do that, we've lost. We, democracy, is lost, because if you've got no public space and you're all going to have a wall three times as high as this room, which is concrete, they've won, we've lost. And actually that was accepted, and then we have got some glass. We do, okay, it's mainly retail, but at least we have something. We have our restaurants and so on.
If you were given the details to build the Lloyd's London now, in what way would you translate modern ideas into that commission?
It's a difficult question you're asking me, because I'm often asked that question. And in a way, you build at the time responding to those needs. Now, we started, for instance, responding to the climate change crisis. Triple glass, special way of ventilating. Triple glass allowed you to go right close to the glass without having heat and cool. So we did quite a lot of work, but we do much more work on that side today. The situation has got worse in terms of climate change, as we all wave these, whether it's hot or cold. I suppose many of the elements, for instance, all these massive ducts and so on, have now become much smaller. They're easier. The good things about putting the ducts on the outside of the building is that we've recognized that the part of the building has short life. Was basically things like the ducts, like the mechanical services, because they're an engine, and that's like the computer has revolutionized the way we communicate. So air conditioning is now becoming something of the past. We very seldom put air conditioning in buildings in London. In fact, I'm tempted to say never, except when there are dense areas like this. So probably that's the area which we've changed most, would have changed most. But then I'm sure there'd be other areas as well. More public domain, yes, maybe now that the problems, merely we finished Lloyd's, there were serious problems of bombing. I don't know if you remember, there was a bomb put right in front of it, and that of course was a good reason for closing up the buildings, giving security. Today, London, the city of London, is much more alive. I mean, it is fascinating to go up. If you go up in the evening, whether you go to Canary Wharf, I was wrong there, actually, by the way. I thought Canary Wharf would never work because there's not enough mix. Well, there isn't enough mix, but boy, there are a lot of people who enjoy themselves, especially on a Friday night. So there is a vitality in the city, and maybe we're less worried about closing anything up as we were concerned when we finished Lloyd's.
You're listening to Changing the City, an audience with Richard Rodgers on the BBC World Service.
Weekdays on the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Shaima Khalil.
The mood here is one of defiance, but it's also one of anger.
Coming from Egypt and experiencing life across the Middle East, I have a deep understanding of the region.
And this is post-revolution. This is the Egypt where everyone is fighting for their freedom, but apparently I'm not free to get into some place because of what I wear.
I've traveled quite a bit, and the one constant in all of this traveling was the BBC. From a very early age, I was drawn to its rich content of news and culture, whether in English or in Arabic.
Two men fighting it out, seeing who will concede, who's going to back up. Kind of sums up Egyptian politics, actually.
To me, Newsday is about a team of people with hugely diverse backgrounds who bring their own wealth of experience to the stories we cover.
You're listening to Newsday with Shaima Khalil and Tom Hagler in London.
Join me, Shaima Khalil, on the BBC World Service on Newsday from 5 GMT.
You're listening to Changing the City, an audience with Richard Rodgers on the BBC World Service. I'm Razia Iqbal, and I'm talking to the architect Richard Rodgers about his passion for turning buildings inside out. We've discussed the Pompidou Centre in Paris and the Lloyd's Building in London. Next, we'll be coming to the way the world's cities are developing, the politics of city planning, and Lord Rodgers' occasional but continual bruising confrontations with His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. That's after the news.
BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. Protests are taking place in over 100 American cities to express anger at the acquittal last week of George Zimmerman, who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager in February last year. The parents of Trayvon Martin are leading demonstrations in New York and Miami. Police in India say they found high levels of agricultural pesticide in cooking oil and leftover food at a school where 23 children died after eating lunch earlier this week. Police say the samples from the school in Bihar contain very toxic levels of an organophosphorus compound. Israel says it's planning to release a limited number of Palestinian prisoners as part of a deal to restart peace talks. The International Relations Minister said the prisoners would be freed in stages, describing some of them as heavyweights who'd been in prison for up to 30 years. Switzerland's largest geothermal energy project has been halted after drilling deep underground triggered an earthquake. The tremor was felt over a wide area in the northeast, but it caused no material damage. Fire crew in the Costa Concordia cruise ship disaster have been given jail sentences for manslaughter. More than 30 people died when the ship struck rocks and capsized off the Italian island of Giglio last year. The ship's captain, Francesco Schettino, has been tried separately. The security forces in Algeria say they've killed a deputy leader of Al-Qaeda in North Africa, along with three other Islamist militants. They said the militants were killed in a raid on Friday night in a region southeast of the capital, Algiers. And the former White House correspondent Helen Thomas has died at the age of 92 after a long illness. Ms. Thomas reported on every president of the United States, from John F. Kennedy to Barack Obama. Her seniority earned her a named front row seat in the White House briefing room. She had a reputation for asking difficult questions. BBC News.
This is Changing the City, an audience with Richard Rogers on the BBC World Service. Richard, cities are your passion. You define them as being the meeting of friends and strangers in civilized public spaces surrounded by beautiful buildings. You're known for your iconic buildings, but the city planning aspect of your work is less identifiable. Tell us a little bit about the projects that you've been involved with around the world when it comes to city planning.
You know, French presidents have a love, like you could go all the way around to sort of Napoleon and Louis XIV, have a love to leave their footprint on cities. And we have benefited.
Otherwise known as the Grand Projet.
The Grand Projet.
They're so much better than us at doing that.
Yes, they like, well, I'm not sure whether it's good or bad, but they do like it. Well, it's probably good. And we were beneficial in the sense of benefited because we had Pompidou. And then I became an advisor to Mitterrand, especially on the competition, Grand Projet. And now we've been asked by Sarkozy, was asked by Sarkozy, and continues now with the new president to look at Paris. Now, we're not the only people looking at Paris. About 10 organizations are looking at how can we improve transportation, political, the politicizing of the city, and so on. And that's very exciting. And I think the ideal city is a compact city. It's the only sustainable form of city. So I believe strongly in using what we call brownfield, which is basically derelict land, buildings which are in bad state and therefore not empty and so on, before we expand outwards. The compact city is where you meet people, you need to be close together. The last thing you want is big, large, empty spaces. London especially was a massive industrial city. England was a industrial country. We make very little. So we have vast areas of empty land. So we intensify, we retrofit, very good word, retrofit. We all, many of us live in or work in spaces which are not designed for what the activity they are retrofitted. The ground too is retrofitted because it used to be one thing and it is another.
Let's expand on this idea, because you advised here in the United Kingdom London mayors, Ken Livingstone as well as Boris Johnson. In the 1990s, when the Labour government were in office, you were appointed to lead the Urban Task Force. And that is now credited with having had a huge influence in city planning in this country. Intellectually, a lot of it made huge sense and still does, except I wonder if we can just consider this, that not everyone wants to live in a dense urban environment, particularly families with small children.
I think it's perfectly reasonable. And suburbia, there are a lot of housing. Unfortunately, suburbia is basically car-based, because otherwise there wouldn't be suburbia. If you go in the country, it's car-based. I've got nothing against gardens. I had no way I stopped people from living in suburbia. But you need to develop transportation processes which pick up people in suburbia. Pretty difficult. By the way, it's only 10% of suburban houses have got children in it. Most of the people who move out to suburbia, not all, because there are people who just want to be there, are there because it's cheaper. They're pushed out. If I ask people in my office, why do you live here or there, they all say, we would prefer to live in the centre, but you can't afford it. Nowadays, it's impossible to afford it, and that's a problem.
Let's move on to a slightly different topic. You're a lord now, and you're a member of the British establishment in many ways, yet you still manage to fall foul of the heir to the throne, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. You've blamed his opposition for the failure of your scheme for Paternoster Square around St Paul's Cathedral. He's been implicated in the failure of your plan for the extension to the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square, and most recently your plans for the development of the former Chelsea Barracks, which were scuppered after he wrote to the financial backers to object the Royal Family of Qatar. Have you tried, personally, engaging him in conversation and listening to his point of view?
I have no objection to the idea that people should have a different opinion. I think the complexity here in terms of Prince Charles is that when people like the BBC, the RIBA, and the Royal Academy wrote to Prince Charles after the first attack, which was, if I remember rightly, was on the National Gallery, and suggested that there should be an open discussion, the reply was, the prince does not debate. That's what I fundamentally disagree with. That is not democratic.
And you would welcome that? You'd want to talk to him?
Yes, I debated with people I didn't agree with, like Thatcher.
What is it? Just let's draw out a little bit of your perception of his objections to your work. Where do you think that comes from?
The place of royalty is through the power of tradition. And if you rationalize it, it would be difficult to come up with a concept of royalty. I'm not now arguing whether they do or don't do a good job, which you can make a very strong argument that they do. But that you can sort of understand why that whole concept of this formality roots you into a situation where you tend to look backwards. The thing about being looking backwards is it's past, therefore it's secure. There's no challenge. So the past is nice, and you know, you say, look, wonderful. Florence or whatever it is, medieval London is beautiful, but we've got used to it. That's why it's so beautiful. When you move forward into the contemporary times, then it's more complicated. Now, you may argue there's more strife now being the modern movement. There was more strife. Now, as you say, basically, it's accepted to be contemporary. Only a few people, I think, I would say, are key people who would argue we need to build a Gothic palace instead of an office building, or a Roman. I mean, how far do you want to go back? Hellenic, because Hellenic architecture is so beautiful, which it is, but it would be pretty strange to build an office building in the Hellenic style.
You are now hugely successful, and I mentioned that you're seen very much as part of the establishment, but when those controversies arose, did you feel bruised by them? I mean, they were very public.
We certainly felt bruised, and when Lloyd's was being opened, I sat next to the Dean of St. Paul's. St. Paul's, that's how I learned my story. I remember he said, Mr. Rogers, do you feel beleaguered? And I said, I sure do, as everybody was throwing sort of eggs and mud and so on. That's at the Lloyd's of London at that time. And he told me that story about Wren, which gave me some cheer that even in his 70s, now I've passed that, but even when he was 70, he was still being said too modern for his time.
You're listening to Changing the City, an audience with Richard Rogers on the BBC World Service. We've been discussing the Lloyd's Building, the Pompidou Centre, Richard's work on planning the cities of the future, and those encounters with His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. But who would like to ask a question now on any of the things that we've just been talking about? Hands gone up in the front, and then the gentleman here in the front.
I just want to return to Paternoster Square and the National Gallery extension. Leaving aside the fact that your concept wasn't used, I wonder what you think about the eventual, really quite postmodern buildings that did get built there.
Let's start with the good news, which is, in a sense, Trafalgar Square. And this, when we did our competition, we linked that side of the street with Trafalgar Square. And today, it is a square, and I don't think anybody, apart from perhaps a few taxi drivers, would say that we need a roundabout. And once upon a time, Trafalgar Square was called the heart of an empire, and I used to call it the roundabout of an empire. And it is now a great place. I don't think it's not my favorite building. Let's put it politely. The new extension. It's having said it, it contains a scale of form. It's not very important. It could have been a really good building. It could have built up the rhythm, which is a pretty clear rhythm on that side. When we built our building, we sort of had a tower, and that was lined up with a dome, and the dome with the St. Martin's Church. So there was a sort of a geometry, but of course it was a 20th century geometry. Postmodernism, I suppose what I should say, I don't understand it. I don't know anybody who would bring their foreign friends to go and see Paternoster Square because it's a great piece of urban planning, which is sad because it could have been a great piece of urban planning. It should have been a great piece because St. Paul's is fantastic. It needs more than some very mediocre buildings surrounding it.
Hello, I'm Michael. I'm from Ireland. Is it not symptomatic of the real position of architecture that the Prince's comments are tolerated, whereas they wouldn't be tolerated if he said them about the economy or political events?
I think, I don't want to go into this in great, make it a single out, but actually the technique of not having, making pronouncements and not having discussions affects three areas: medicine, agriculture, and architecture. And I think they all three suffer, and maybe you could argue more seriously, especially in agriculture. So it's not just architecture. Now, that architects tend not, I continuously say architecture is political, architecture is social. On the whole, architects probably are not that interested, or not as interested as I am on that side. But I think we should, as citizens, we have a right to discuss.
There's a hand there.
There was a period when you were working back in the 70s and 80s where I felt that UK architects were not particularly valued here in the UK. They were far more valued overseas, and that's a theme that I've seen continue over a number of years. Do you think that we as a country are learning to value the talent that we have in this country more?
I think it better than it was. It doesn't mean much, I have to say. No, but it is better than it was. I mean, I often think to myself, yeah, sometimes think of myself as a sort of third generation wave if you go back to the beginning of the 20th century.
But you've built lots here, as has, yes, Norman Foster.
No, I agree. I was about to say that I think the sort of beginning of the 20th century was really tough. The next wave, which is basically the sort of Lasden wave, shall we say, had it medium. Dennis Lasden had a medium, they tough. We have it much easier than they did, your point being made. It's now more or less accepted that if you want an office building, it's going to be a modern office building because no client wants a office building built in the Hellenic style, as I mentioned before.
Well, let's stay with that theme just a little bit and talk about how much architecture has changed in the period that you have been practicing. When you started out, nearly all the architects in this country worked for local authorities. That was true of both you, Norman Foster, who was your former partner and friend. And now we live in an era where there is a huge amount of building going on all over the world, and architects are not only in huge demand, but they're in demand for projects overwhelmingly funded by private capital. Architecture has become, in a way, a resting place for capital accrued elsewhere. Does this worry you? Is this an anxiety that the effect that this will have on our cities and the kinds of buildings that are getting built?
This exhibition, the real name, if you like, is Ethos, which is fairness. And one of the things I try to do in this exhibition is to show the relationship between this social responsibility, citizenship, and so on, and the buildings, spaces even more, that we create, public space that we create. I think there is a danger, and we're living through a period of, and in my opinion, tremendous greed and a lack of recognition of the rights of citizens to have a reasonable life throughout the city and the society. The gap between rich and poor gets bigger and bigger. Going back to the question that you asked me, when I went to the AA, I'm going to say 80%, maybe more, of people leaving schools went immediately into schools department, county council departments, health departments, and so on. This is architects. Today, there are very few that work in those departments, and we've got a situation where the people who really control it is the bankers. It's the market. We are market driven to a point where we have lost a lot of the ability to be socially responsible and to feel that it's unfair for somebody to earn £10 million a year and, you know, a teacher to earn whatever he earns. And if I could just take that one more moment, it is interesting that the countries which are doing best, which probably in terms of architecture, which probably are the Nordic ones from Copenhagen to Oslo, Stockholm, Helsinki and so on, tend to recognize that, therefore pay, for instance, their teachers the same as they pay their doctors. That immediately gives a recognition to the value, and we've lost that.
So in a way, what you're saying is that the way architecture is practiced today, it is creating two-tier cities, which kind of goes completely against what you have argued for decades.
Yes, it just means you have to fight harder. I don't think this will go on forever. There will be some form of recognition that we're already seeing. I mean, the good news in one sense is we're now a global society. The big difference between 1931 crisis and today is that those who are fortunate, and that's people like myself, and that's a very small part, but that is, it is a global market. You can move around. You can also learn about how those societies work. Hopefully we will learn that the traditional capitalist structure is not the only structure that can exist. There will be new structures, and we need, you especially, young people, need to look at the new structures, look at what one can do to create a more civilized society.
How hard is it, though, as an architect running a very successful practice as you do, and many others, say, for example, with the Hyde Park development that you're involved with? In a way, you could argue that there is complicity on your part, or the practices part, in saying we're going to build this, but actually these are apartments that are, what, £20 million, $30 million each?
More.
You know, and this is a division. It's creating a division which goes completely against what you argue for. So why do it? Why take that on?
I think... Yeah, we have a constitution which sort of defines certain things that we do. One of the things we, in fact, said we do work for the rich. Lloyd's is rich. British Airways is rich. We have tried to do, especially in terms of the constitution, one of the points it says, for instance, is that the architect will not earn, the chairman and senior directors or partners will not earn more than let's say about 8 times the lowest paid architect, the rest goes to charity. So we can make those type of statements, but at the same time, of course, we are complicit, as you rightly say, within the society we live in. We have to change the society probably much more at the roots. You know, people say, how can you do airports and also be for climate change? I have a sort of defense, but I'm not sure it goes far. I mean, the argument goes, well, the real problem is not airports, it's carbon tax. That's what we should have. If we had a real carbon tax, we would have to be forced to change the way we travel generally. So we are in some situation. One way we live today, and we are complicit, as you say, within the capitalist society. Another sense, we do what we can to change that, to go back to the idea, there is a word, wonderful word, which is fairness.
Let's talk about public housing, because it's an issue all over the world, and there are few signs that anything that's where investment is needed, if there ever was a place where you needed money to be invested. What's the way forward, do you think, when land in cities is expensive and high returns are required by investors? Because in the end, that's what they want. They want a return for their money. How is it possible to see affordable housing inside cities?
There are a number of things. First of all, I think it's a question of funding. The real problem is not, as you say rightly, private housing. Private housing, the number that we build, which is about 100,000 a year, has been consistent more or less since after the war. What's really happened is social housing. We have no social housing. Now, you have to argue, but we're still paying 40% taxes, so why don't we use the money to encourage social housing and invest in it, and that would itself create more employment, which would better our economic situation. So that's one. The other thing is it's very difficult. Housing market is the most difficult in terms of design. I think offices are pretty refined in their structures. Commercial centres generally. Housing, we still build them brick by brick. They're still very expensive, they're very slow, and usually rather poor. in their way that they deal with climate change. Now, there are exceptions. There are some developers who are now moving out of that, who are working now much more closer to the cutting edge, both in terms of cost and quality.
It's a sweltering evening here in central London. We've had car horns intervening, and we're going to have an air conditioning fan intervening any second now, because we're all suffering in here. Richard, when you look at the global picture in terms of cities, you've talked a little bit about the Nordic cities doing particularly well. Which ones do you think that are not the Scandinavian ones face the future with confidence and a concern with all sectors of society? So with a view to trying to get the balance right between serving those who are well off and those who are less well off?
I mean, the more exciting towns, I suppose, probably in Holland, if I'm not allowed to quote the Nordic ones. Spain was doing very well before its immense economic crisis, but it was really doing wonderfully well. There are countries, I mean, if you go further afield, what's happening in New Zealand looks very extremely interesting. So there are countries which are moving forward, especially on the housing field.
Do you watch with interest when you see demonstrations breaking out in cities in Brazil and in Istanbul recently, where you have people protesting against, in the case of Istanbul, it was to do with development of Gezi Park, but in Brazil, it was to do with all sorts of issues, social issues, including not having cheap access to transportation.
Of course, and we've had our own problems lately here. You know, we had our own riots. We mustn't forget our own. They may be small in comparison. And of course, people are going to object if they feel they're not getting a fair deal. And I sympathize with, I mean, it depends what it is, obviously, but I can understand why people react. I mean, Pompidou Center was very much an outcome of the uprising of students, intellectuals, and workers, which really threatened
the 1968 demonstrations.
Exactly, which threatened Europe. It's said that Pompidou had his airplane ready to go to Germany because he thought he was going to lose it. The Vietnam War, the reaction against the Vietnam War, which spread out well beyond the borders of the States. You can understand why people react, and I think we should react and participate, if possible in a civilized way, against what we think is unfair.
Let me ask you about professional rivalries, because we've talked quite a lot about Trafalgar Square. Of course, your plan was rejected, and Norman Foster, your good friend and former partner, got to build what we now see in Trafalgar Square. What do you think about that? What are your reflections?
I think it's great. we weren't actually rejected, but having said that, I would have loved to have done it. No, I think, but there are lots more. We nearly got Parliament Square. And we will get Parliament Square pedestrianised. You know, we will be cutting down on the use of cars in central London. Great.
It's very clever, Richard. You've managed to deflect answering that question about professional rivalries, so I'm going to ask you in a different way. So Norman Foster and you are both building on Ground Zero. You know, you two go back a long, long way. You know, you first met when you were both students at Yale, Architecture School in America, and Is there a rivalry, or is the basis of your relationship still profoundly to do with friendship?
I think we are profoundly friendship first. I mean, Renzo Piano, who is my partner in Pompidou, and who are probably my closest colleague. I mean, we do occasionally compete. I don't think anybody feels. I mean, it's good when that good art building is is built or designed. So I can't. I mean, clearly, I go home sometimes feeling a bit sore when I've just lost something to Norman, but there we go.
You're listening to Changing the City, an audience with Richard Rogers on the BBC World Service. We're at the Royal Academy in central London. We've been discussing, among other things, the Lloyds Building, the Pompidou Centre, the City Square, the cities of the future. Who would now like to ask a question? The last opportunity that you've got to ask Richard Rogers a question. Hand going up straight there in the front.
What kind of buildings do you want to build now? Do you want to build bigger buildings now, or do you want to build smaller buildings?
I think there's an importance to recognize that size is not of a major importance. It depends how you measure things, my point about Pompidou or Leadenhall. What the future is, I mean, in a sense, I like public buildings, don't do many, like public spaces. But I mean, I'm extremely proud of Leadenhall. It's been a very successful building. I've got a brilliant partner in charge, or there is a brilliant Graham Stirk, and it's work. It looks like it'll work very well, and no doubt I will love it as much and when it's finished as any building I've ever built, or we have ever built.
Hi, I'm Drew from London. Lloyd's was built with flexibility in mind. You also know buildings are of the time. However, services like air conditioning are much smaller and easier to incorporate now. Lloyd's is now quite rightly grade one listed. Obviously the services will need to be upgraded over its lifetime, but it cannot freely evolve anymore. So the question is, how do you think it can evolve in the future? And do you think it should remain of its time or true to its concept of flexibility and change?
It's a very interesting question you're asking. When Lloyd's was, we didn't know it was going to be a sort of highest level of heritage, but we knew that it was going to be. And we agreed with English Heritage and with Lloyd's that we would do a plan which showed areas where change could take place. Whether we've done it right, I doubt it, but we've gone some way down that path, let's put it there. I think the danger of buildings which are sort of completely frozen in time is people will just, they'll end up by being empty, and that's the worst thing that can happen to a piece of heritage. So you've got to give a certain amount to what is needed at the time, and you've got to try and get that balance. There's no perfect answer to yours, but the only answer you've got is to worry about it.
Gentleman in the front.
My name's Matthew Gibbs, and I'm about to start my fifth year of architecture studies. My question is to you, what is your most favourite building that you have built? And you can only pick one, and why?
Maybe my parents' house.
This is your parents' house in Wimbledon, in South London.
Yes, because I suppose that's where I started, in a way. And much of what I have gone on since then has got its roots in that house. I mean, it's a difficult one. Obviously, the most influential building in terms of what we've been talking about, which is socio-political, is the Pompidou Centre, because it has had an environmental effect in that whole district, and it's very popular. It's more people go to it than any public building in Europe, and so on.
But just can't decide. You're only asked to pick one.
And I can't. It's like picking one child. I've got lots of those. So it depends on the day. Sometimes, one can pick a child and say, I'm not going to have him again. But
family is so important to you, Richard. Your son lives in that house that you built for your parents.
Yes, AB, yes. Yes.
And he's been involved in this. He did the exhibition as well.
The design of the exhibition, yeah. If architecture and family are my two most passionate, sir.
This has been an enormous treat for me, and I hope for all of you here and everyone listening. Thank you so much for celebrating your 80th birthday with us. Please will everyone join me now in giving a rousing round of applause to a wonderful man and a great architect, Richard Rogers.